This is Marathon Trading Academy, episode 277.
This episode is brought to you by Yoga Body, makers of the Yoga Trapeze. Inversion therapy has been used for decades as a way to reverse the pressure on your lower back and create more space between your vertebrae. And the Yoga Trapeze makes it fun and easy to hang upside down at home and release pent-up tension. You can try the Yoga Trapeze for 30 days for just $1 by going to yogatrapeze.com. And if you use the coupon code MARATHON, you'll get a free instructional DVD with your order. That's yogatrapeze.com and use the coupon code MARATHON to learn more.
This podcast is also brought to you by Topo Athletic, a gimmick-free running shoe company that delivers footwear solutions for healthier, more natural running patterns. I've been running in these shoes for a couple years now and just love them. They have a roomy toe box, which promotes functional foot movement, and they have a cushioned midsole that comes in a variety of thicknesses and heel elevations. I personally like to run in a really low drop, but you can pick your unique level of protection and comfort when you visit topoathletic.com/MTA. And with our special link and code, you can get 10% off your first pair. That's Topo, T-O-P-O, athletic.com/MTA. Welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast, where we help you take your running and health to the next level. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we speak with author and fitness guru, Ben Greenfield. And in this episode's quick tip, Angie will answer a listener question about how to stay in marathon shape. And just a heads up, you can get all of our back podcast episodes, training plans, and more with an Academy membership. Check it out at marathontrainingacademy.com. So Angie, I think in the whole month of February, I ran outside twice. And one of those times was in Florida at the half marathon that I did in Tallahassee.
You put in plenty of time on the treadmill, so it wasn't like you didn't train at all last month.
Exactly. Just outside only twice because of the bitter temperatures. How about you?
I would say I've been doing about 50-50 outside and treadmill running. I actually did my long run, which wasn't super long this morning, on the treadmill, just because I didn't feel like fighting the bracing temperatures, and I kind of have like a sore throat, so I'm kind of, you know, trying to baby my body a bit.
How long did you go?
9 miles.
So how do you get yourself psyched up to do a long run on the treadmill? I haven't found out that secret yet.
I think the secret is there is no secret. You just have to do it. I mean, don't give yourself an out, you know, and then arm yourself with things that will make you more comfortable. Like I always put the fan on our treadmill. And I usually just wear a sports bra so that I don't have anything else that, you know, makes me too warm. And I've got my bottle of electrolyte solution right there to drink, and usually an audiobook to listen to, and then you just go to town.
So that's what's going on around here. In our last episode, Angie gave us a little recap of the Red Rock Canyon Marathon, which she did, and she decided to race walk the whole way. And we had some great feedback about that and just the whole concept of race walking. And so, Angie, you got a comment, actually, that was interesting that why don't you read for us real quick.
Adolfo left this comment over on our blog, and I have to say I met him at the Jacksonville Marathon a few years ago. So
yeah, he's been a long-time listener.
Yeah, he is. He says, as someone who rescued his running career after 3 years of race walking, I want to thank you for your episode on this issue, as well as congratulate you on your time. My PR after training my ass off was 5:33 at the Marine Corps Marathon in 2014, and you did 5:31 on a whim. He says, my main point here is that you made sure you race walk and not just fast walk. And most importantly, you did your research not to confuse them and to make sure your audience understood the difference. Race walking is a well-defined yet seldom understood athletic endeavor. It requires preparation, consistency, and lots of concentration. It also requires a thick skin to avoid getting stung by comments at races and in the streets on the funny way you're moving. As a former runner who had to leave the asphalt for over 25 years because of knee issues, race walking gave me the chance to return. It also allowed me to get my legs and body strong enough to try running again 3 years later. I'm living proof that it works, and thus thank you for bringing this discipline to the forefront and for giving it a shot. The best book about race walking is The Complete Guide to Race Walking by Dave McGovern. If you want to give this a shot, this is your go-to book. Thanks for the podcast. It's been a staple in my training since my race walking days.
Yeah, if you haven't heard it, go back. It's episode 276. It's just an experiment that Angie wanted to try to see how fast she could walk a marathon, because I've always teased her about being a fast walker. Have you even figured out like what setting on the treadmill you were walking at? I think you were walking at like a 4.5 on our treadmill.
Probably, yeah, probably close to that.
So folks, go give that a try. My comfortable walking pace is 2 on the treadmill.
What? 2?
I'm serious. Like 3 is like, oh man, this is not comfortable. So, because I was experimenting with it after our episode.
Oh, that's hilarious.
So everybody go try a 4.5. I think that's around a 12-minute mile.
No, it's slower than a 12-minute mile because 5.0 is like a 12-minute mile.
Okay, and that's what you were doing, right?
Well, I averaged a 12:40 mile. I had 1 mile that was like 11:33.
Okay, so put the treadmill on 5. That's like what Andy's walking at. That's like my zone 2 running speed lately.
It's okay. It's all relative.
So we got the London Marathon coming up next month. Angie, how's your training going?
I'm feeling good. Yeah, I'm feeling really optimistic about it. Obviously, anytime you travel to a big marathon, it can be more exhausting on the body. So, you know, I'm not going to put a ton of pressure on myself for the race itself. Really want to enjoy it, but also to perform my best, whatever that is. And of course, we're excited to be hosting a meetup in London the day before the marathon.
That's right. We're going to host an afternoon tea, you know, because we're in England. That's going to be on April 27th at 2 p.m. local time. If you're going to be at the London Marathon and you want to join us and other runners and listeners to the MTA podcast, these meetups are always a lot of fun. There's more details about it on our website. We have an itinerary on our website. If you go over there on the tab, it says About. And we also have a Facebook event, but if you're not on Facebook, you can always find out more details on our website or email me, trevor@marathontrainingacademy.com. And of course, we are running for the John Muir Trust. Really happy about that. Here's a quote from John Muir for this episode. He said, "I know that our bodies are made to thrive only in pure air and the scenes in which pure air is found." So what about you, Angie? Does your body thrive out where the pure air is?
Oh, definitely.
That's why I love trail running. And of course, the John Muir Trust gets its name from the conservationist John Muir, but the trust was actually founded in 1983 in the UK to raise awareness of the benefits of wild land. And one of the founders of the John Muir Trust was a runner named Chris Brasher. I think he passed away in 2003. But you know what Chris Brasher, what he's most famous for?
What's that?
He, along with John Disley, founded the London Marathon.
Wow. What year was that?
1981.
That is awesome.
Imagine having that on your resume.
Pretty amazing.
What'd you do with your life? Founded the John Muir Trust and the London Marathon. I mean, come on. So yeah, this is all really exciting. And we're planting a MTA podcast forest in Scotland. £10, which is about $13, I think, will plant one tree. And we're hoping to get 262 trees planted. Thank you to everyone so far that has helped us plant a tree and donated to that. If you want to help out, go to johnmuirtrust.org/MTA. And like I said, it's only £10 to plant one tree. All right. So Angie, before we get into our conversation with Ben, tell us what is going on out there in MTA land. What are folks up to these days?
Well, of course, they're taking action in their goals like we always encourage people to do. We got this note from Kevin. He says, "I knocked out my first 10-mile race of the year, got a 4-minute personal course PR, was also able to run in a small snow flurry, which was a first, but I enjoyed every minute."
Running is an all-weather sport, right?
That's right. Karima posted, she says, "I got a new half PR of 1 hour, 23 minutes, and 45 seconds. And
nice.
And third place at the One City Half Marathon. The course and weather were perfect. Thanks to MTA coach Steve and the MTA community."
Always impressed how fast she is.
Yes, she's tearing it up. And congratulations to Anissa. She says, "I finished my first marathon. It was so hot, 85 degrees Fahrenheit and humid. Thank you, MTA coach Dominique, for getting me here."
Yeah, and that was in Florida, Treasure Coast Marathon. Keep up the great work, Anissa, and congrats on accomplishing your first marathon.
And this last note actually comes from MTA coach Steve. He says, "I ran the Napa Valley Marathon this morning in preparation for Boston. I wanted to keep this under 3 hours, but there were 26 miles of headwinds. After 2 hours, 59 minutes, and 48 seconds, I crossed the finish line, but had to dig a little deeper than I wanted. I was third in my age group, so I got a bottle of champagne."
Wow, that's awesome. Keeping it under 3 hours, getting a bottle of champagne at the end. Sounds like an epic day.
That's right.
So congrats, Coach Steve, and thanks for leading by example. We have 9 coaches now on the team at MTA and lots of clients doing amazing things. And we're able to now, because of the depth of our team, to work with clients that have all kinds of goals, whether they're like Karima, a 123 half marathoner or a sub-3 hour marathoner, or if they're race walking or just beginners or building back from injury, pregnancy, just all kinds of runners that we're able to take now and help. So yeah, really excited to see how this thing has evolved. Well, in this episode, we are going to talk with Ben Greenfield. He's been in the health and fitness podcasting space longer than we have. In fact, he was the first big podcaster to reach out to us after we launched this show back in 2010. We used to have him on the show every year for many years. Ben is a competitive triathlete, personal trainer, biohacker, speaker, and author. And Ben is a walking encyclopedia of health and fitness knowledge. So it's always fun to talk to him. And in this conversation, you will hear about transitioning to obstacle racing, building strength. He shares tips on breathing for runners, also ways to biohack your house, tips on improving the quality of your sleep, and his thoughts on screen time and its effect on kids, and also some of his parenting philosophy. So it's a wide-ranging conversation with a very interesting guy, and I know you folks will love it. So let's go ahead and jump into our conversation with fitness guru Ben Greenfield right now. Well on my way, well on my way. All right, we're on the podcast now with Ben Greenfield, joining us from his home in Spokane, Washington. Ben, great to have you back on the MTA podcast.
Yeah, it's been a little while.
When we first started the show back in 2010, I think you were the first person to reach out to us and saw that we had a podcast, and you were one of our first guests.
Yeah, I think that was back when I was working on a marathon training program, and we were chatting about different ways to skin the marathon cat, different ways to train for that. Even though at the time, the primary marathons I was running were kind of for dessert at the end of an Ironman.
Yeah,
and that's really the majority of marathons I've personally run have been during an Ironman triathlon.
Yeah.
So yeah, I do remember that way back in the 2010. Wow.
What's your marathon PR at the end of a triathlon?
3:14.
Nice.
That's pretty fast for having, you know, rode your bike for 100 miles or whatever.
Well, yeah, typically I really think the way to do a marathon in an Ironman is by using a negative split. I mean, you come off the bike, and I would always use the first 13 miles or so to refuel, rehydrate, you know, get my legs under me. And basically it's just a matter of maintenance up until you get to the point where you've got about 13 miles left. And then what I found worked really well would be to run about 10K or so of that as like a build up to your maximum sustainable pace. And then you run the final 10K of the race, just basically, you know, digging deep and, you know, finishing off your glycogen stores and taking all that maintenance that you've been doing for the past several hours. And, and you wind up passing literally hundreds of people at the end of the race who are walking, because most people do the complete opposite of a negative split in an Ironman. They come off the bike and just go charging out. And, you know, a few miles in, they're just fatigued and hungry and exhausted. Whereas I'm a fan of kind of going out slow and then in that last half marathon building, and then finally for the final 10K, just basically laying it all out on the line.
That makes sense. So, you know, it's been a while. It's been like 9 years or so when we first had you on as a guest, and you don't sit still at all. I mean, you're like constantly trying new things. It seems like your evolution has been since we have been aware of you. You've gone from triathlons, and then you started doing obstacle racing, getting really involved, you know, competitively in that, right?
Yeah, exactly. I remember coming out of triathlon, you know, I had an aerobic engine, you know, I could go for days, so to speak, but, you know, my lactic acid tolerance was pretty high too. But I remember the first time I jumped into a Spartan, you know, I was literally just, you know, wearing my triathlon spandex, and I started the race, and I went off just fine with the lead pack, but found quite frustratingly during the event that I could not carry a heavy sandbag to save my life. I couldn't climb a rope. I didn't have the hip mobility to get underneath the barbed wire quickly. You know, I couldn't hoist these heavy weights and do all the things that were required to complete the race in a respectable time. And so, you know, that was a real light bulb moment for me where I was like, wow, I'm fit, but I'm weak. I'm fit, but I'm weak. And so what I liked about obstacle course racing was, you know, I've done races that last from, you know, 30 to 40 minutes up to 3 days during those events, primarily Spartans and Tough Mudders. And man, my body now is stronger and more powerful, but I haven't lost my aerobic endurance. So I think it's a great method of cross training. You know, it keeps you strong. It's a little bit more functional because you're carrying heavy stuff. You're sprinting a little bit. You're running a little bit. You're crawling. You know, you're stepping. You're lunging. There's just, to me, compared to kind of pounding the pavement, there's just so much more variation that gets thrown at your body. I think it's a really, really good, you know, functional fitness type of sport. And as compared to something like, say, CrossFit or American Ninja Warrior, there's a real, you know, especially interestingly for your audience, a real aerobic and endurance component too in these races. You know, people ask me, well, why don't you do American Ninja Warrior? Well, it's because I'm an endurance athlete, and you know, the 5 foot tall Japanese rock climbers, not to stereotype, right? You know, that's a type that tends to do well in American Ninja Warrior. And I say, well, you know, a Spartan race is like American Ninja Warrior spread out through the forest over 6 miles or 8 miles or 13 miles or whatever. And you're running great distances between each of these obstacles. And I like that.
So for the runner out there who is primarily has just done cardio in the past, you know, what would you recommend as far as building some more of that functional fitness and that strength?
Yeah. You know, I'm a big fan of concurrent training, which is where you combine strength and endurance training, because that's generally what you'll encounter in a race like this anyway. So whereas, you know, if you're training for a marathon, you generally have certain days where you do your strength training. And then if you're doing a two-a-day, kind of a different time of day when you might go out for your run or your aerobic cross training, like say you're swimming or cycling, or you would have your strength training on one or two or 3 days of the week. And then on the in-between days, you know, that's when you do your running, you know, like, you know, running on a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you know, Saturday, Sunday, and, you know, doing lifting on a Monday and a Friday. With concurrent training, generally, it's all done in one big mishmash of a workout, meaning that, well, it's tough to not do concurrent training in a gym, although it can be done. I have certain workouts where you'll go out on a trail run, and every mile you got to, you know, fight a heavy rock and carry that rock for 100 yards and, you know, and then stop at a tree branch and do 10 pull-ups, you know, almost like fartlek speed training, kind of where you're making things up as you go. And as you see heavy things or things you can crawl under, you know, almost kind of like parkour through the trail. But that's kind of tough. It's unpredictable. And, you know, what I like to do, you know, for a really good concurrent strength workout is basically you're in a gym with a treadmill. And you might show up and do a warm up on a treadmill for 5 to 10 minutes. And then you would do, for example, 2 minutes on the treadmill at your maximum sustainable pace. Then you'd hop off and you'd go into push ups, pull ups, some kind of overhead press, some kind of deadlift, some kind of squat. And then with as little rest as possible, you're back onto the treadmill again for another 2 minute repeat. And maybe you do rounds of that for, you know, for a good 6 to 8 rounds. And so you're training your body to go back and forth from running to strength. And when you look at something like an obstacle course race, a lot of people ask me, you know, what's kind of like the best way to train for one of those. And I tell them, well, if you could work on three things, it would be A, grip strength. And the way I personally do that is I probably have 4 pull-up bars in my house. So anytime I'm just wandering around the house, I'll just stop and hang and do pull-ups, or I'll be on the phone sometimes, just kind of like, you know, hanging there, just training the grip strength. I also like to do a lot of deadlifts and some kind of pull-up or hang are very good for the grip strength. So that's number one. Number two is your running efficiency, because you're just so smoked sometimes from an upper body or a core standpoint that you have to have really good turnover, really good relaxed gait, and be able to, you know, running efficiency for marathoning or triathlon or anything is important, but it's certainly something that some athletes will neglect in favor of building the strength or the power, and they'll never actually get like a biomechanical gait analysis at a physical therapist's office or a sports performance center, or they'll never really, you know, go and study a book, you know, like chi running or pose running or some form of adjustments to make the running more efficient. So you got running efficiency and you have grip strength. And then the last one is lactic acid tolerance, meaning being able to shift the blood really rapidly from upper body to lower body, back to upper body again, back to lower body. There's a great deal of time that's lost in a typical obstacle course race when you come off an obstacle, like a strength obstacle, and you walk for like 50 feet to kind of recover and then start running again. Well, the sooner you can start running, the better you're going to do, which is why I like those kind of gym workouts where you're going from the treadmill to the strength, back to the treadmill, because you're kind of training that energy system pretty efficiently.
People are going to be wondering if you're hanging on a pull-up bar right now.
No, I'm walking on my treadmill right now. I tend to cover about a good 3 or 4 miles a day at work. Just, you know, I'll do some dictation of emails on my treadmill or a podcast like this or a phone call or whatever.
So you got one of those treadmill desks maybe, huh?
Yeah, but it's on my website. I have a kind of like a diagram of how I did this. If you were to go there and do a search for a treadmill workstation, you'd probably find it. But what I have is one of these TrueForm treadmills, because it's like it's curved and it's manual. It can only be powered by your own body, and you can only really move the belt if you have a slight forward lean, slight forward center of gravity. So I like it not only because I can walk pretty comfortably on it during the day, but I can also use it for training. I can run on it. Or I can even at certain points during the day, you know, kind of like, you know, this idea of inserting brief spurts of high intensity exercise throughout the day as like a fitness tactic. I can just hop on here and, you know, sprint for 30 seconds in between a phone call or whatever and, you know, just do a quick heart rate boost. But what I did was, before they sent this treadmill to me, I had them like remove and cut off the whole front dashboard. So it's just open on the front and there's nothing in between me and my desk. And then what I have is one of these, like hand crank desks that goes up and down. Mm-hmm. The model I have is this one's a Rebel desk, and I'll just turn that hand crank and it'll go up or down, so I can, you know, go on or off the treadmill. I can stand, I can walk, I can run. And then, that's how I have it set up.
I was wondering why we didn't even hear it.
Yeah. I'm not a fan of, have you guys ever been on an incline treadmill, like a Nordic incline treadmill?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I've got one of those out in the garage, and I like that. That'll go up to 40%.
Wow.
And so that's good, because a lot of these, like, Spartan races, they're out in the mountains, and a lot of times they'll have them at ski resorts, right? So you're going up and down these hills over and over again. And if you haven't trained your body to be in that amount of dorsiflexion, you know, like, your ankles are really, really flexed. When you're going up an incline of that magnitude, your calves get super tired and your feet can't handle it. So I really like that incline trainer out in the garage, you know, for really training for the mountains. And I'll do everything from, you know, I do bow hunting. So I'll train for a bow hunt by just putting on my backpack and holding my bow and just walking, you know, uphill for 45 minutes. And then I'll also use that for that. You know, I've got some weights out in the garage, and I'll do that kind of strength/endurance mashup of training that I described to you earlier using that. But that's all out in the garage. I don't like all the noise and the electricity and all that jazz when I'm inside working.
So after you got into obstacle racing, did you go on from there and start doing something else, or are you still competing in obstacle racing?
Yeah, I still race for the Spartan Pro Team in obstacle racing.
Okay.
And it's most of my fitness is that. I do a little bit of jiu-jitsu. Do a lot of bow hunting. So, you know, that's a lot of like crawling and bear crawling and lots of miles throughout the week. You know, a typical 5-day hunt, you might cover, you know, 60, 70 miles on foot. And a lot of that's kind of gnarly territory. And so that's kind of a challenge. I also, I go and teach at a lot of these kind of like immersive events. Like there's one called Roonga that I teach at, and another one called XPT. And a lot of these events are kind of like kettlebell training and breath work and body weight training. And so I still do, you know, quite a bit of that. I work with the kettlebells a lot. I do a lot of, I guess you'd call it like Wim Hof style breath work, or, you know, hypoxic breath work, or different forms of breath training. And then I also do a lot of hot and cold, you know, like sauna and like cold soaks and things like that.
So with the breath training, Are there any misunderstandings that runners typically have when it comes to breathing, or maybe not misunderstandings, but like myths or things that people haven't considered when it comes to just breathing when they're on a run?
Yeah, there's a couple really good concepts here. Like Bud Coates has his book.
Running on Air, right?
Yeah, Running on Air, that teaches this method of rhythmic breathing, right? Timing your breathing to your step pace and increasing your breath frequency as the intensity increases, but decreasing the breath frequency as the intensity decreases. And in that book, you even learn how to time your exhale to the actual foot strike so that you are at less risk of diaphragmatic spasm or some of the internal organs kind of jarring in the wrong direction when your foot strikes the ground, which is one of the reasons people get side stitches. So it's a very, very good book that teaches you how to pair your breathing to your pace rather than just kind of breathing how you want to breathe, you know, randomly as you run. You might breathe in, two, three, out, two, in, two, three, out, two. And as you speed up, I mean, you might be in, two, out, in, two, out, in, two, out. And breath awareness, I think, is very important. I also really like Patrick McCown's book, The Oxygen Advantage, because in that book, he teaches you how to nasal breathe. And yeah, you're going to reach an intensity at some point during exercise at which mouth breathing becomes necessary. But this idea of breathing through the nose, because the nasal passages warm the air, humidify it, you get better oxygen delivery, you get better filtration of the air, and your heart rate remains lower, because as soon as you start chest breathing, you've got all these things called baroreceptors in your chest that cause kind of a cortisol stress activation as you begin to engage in shallow chest breathing and nasal deep diaphragmatic breathing. Training yourself how to do that, even at higher intensities, is a very good skill to be able to maintain efficiency and relaxation. You know, I know people who will be at a good 80% of their maximum pace and still able to breathe through their nose. You know, they used to have the little Spartan kids, you know, during the Agoge, you know, when they train the Spartan children, like not like modern day Spartan races, but actual historical, you know, Spartan warriors. And they would have to run, you know, like a 3 or 5 mile run with a mouthful of gravel or a mouthful of water and be able to keep that in their mouth the whole time by breathing through their nose. And I really like that as a breathwork tactic for endurance athletes as well. And I think that if you can learn how to rhythmically breathe with a book like Running on Air, and then you get a book like The Oxygen Advantage, and you also learn how to nasal breathe, you've really got two very, very important components of breathwork nailed.
Well, that sounds really interesting. Taking it outside of the, you know, the training, the running, I think probably people don't realize how shallowly they breathe during the day, or even probably periods of breath holding. You know, if you kind of monitor yourself, maybe in a stressful situation, a lot of times we hold our breaths, or, you know, like you said, we're doing that diaphragmatic breathing, which doesn't really expand our lungs very thoroughly. So are there any tips like during the day how people can work on their breath?
Yeah, that's a big problem during sleep too. A lot of people they'll go through a night of sleep but not realize how little actual deep sleep they get, because every time that you begin to breathe shallow, like sleep apnea, either because of a poor pillow position or some kind of blockage in the nasal cavities due to either, you know, food intolerance or food allergy causing mucus buildup, or an actual, you know, facial symmetry issue. Sleep apnea is a big issue related to breath work as well. So a lot of people will get through a night of sleep and not feel recovered because they have sleep apnea. And very, very simple to fix with, you know, customized mouthpieces and learning how to nasal breathe as you sleep. Many people now are using what's called mouth taping, you know, buying mouth tape, like there's one company called SomniFix. You know, you can get it on Amazon and you just kind of tape over your mouth and breathe through your nose while you sleep to train yourself away from sleep apnea. But believe it or not, it's very interesting. Patrick McCown talks about that in his book Oxygen Advantage as well. This idea of nasal breathing, not only while you're running, but also during sleep. And what's interesting is the same tactic can work when you're just training yourself to breathe during the day. Like you can, if you don't have a lot of talking to do at work, you can mouth tape and just focus on nasal breathing and training yourself how to do these deep nasal breaths. Another one that I like is there's this little device called a relaxator. You can hold it in your mouth as you're walking. Some people use it when they're running. I don't like the feel of it when I'm running, but it's very good for just like walking, working on emails, etc. And it's like this two-way valve, and this little it's just like this little, almost like a whistle that goes in your mouth. You can hang it around your neck and just kind of use it on and off during the day. But it forces you to breathe in through your nose because it's like a one-way valve. You just can't breathe in through it, but you can breathe out through it. So it's like in through the nose, out through the mouth. But the part with breathing out through the mouth is it gives a little bit of resistance against breathing out through the mouth. And so it forces you to breathe out more slowly, which is very interesting because this means that when you breathe in through your nose, you're getting more oxygen. And then when you breathe out through your mouth, but you breathe out through your mouth slowly, you're kind of retaining some carbon dioxide. And a lot of people think, oh, carbon dioxide is acidic. You know, you don't want too much carbon dioxide in your system. That's like a bad molecule, like more and more and more oxygen, less carbon dioxide. But carbon dioxide is the actual gas that's used as a signaling mechanism to get the hemoglobin to dump off oxygen in the tissue. So really, ideally, you should have both high levels of oxygen and high levels of carbon dioxide simultaneously. And the best way to do that is to breathe through your nose and then breathe out through your mouth, but breathe out through your mouth very slowly. Like, you know, so you'd breathe like in through your nose and then the breath out through the mouth would be. So the breath out through the mouth is sometimes 2 to 4 times longer than the inhalation. And that's a really good way to train yourself how to maintain oxygen and CO2 and also engage in deep diaphragmatic breathing. So that's a really good one too, that relaxator, any kind of mouth taping. And then there are a lot of devices now that will measure your respiratory rate. And ideally you'd want that at 12 or lower per minute, like 12 breaths or lower per minute, unless of course you're exercising. And, you know, like I wear a ring, it's called an Aura that does this. There are some other devices. I think the Whoop, which is like a wristband, will measure breath rate. You can, of course, use the old school method and just try and count how many times you're breathing per minute. But I like to be able to, you know, pull up a little app and just see, oh, hey, you know, when I'm at work from whatever, during the time checking emails from 11 to 12, like my breath rate's, you know, it's highly erratic, or I appear to be holding my breath, or it's very high, or, you know, for me, usually it's holding the breath. I find that that's a big thing for me when I'm in a state of stress. You know, I tend to just hold it all in and, you know, find myself sometimes reading an email and just like holding my breath, which mm-hmm. you kind of want to train yourself away from. So those are a few little tips there.
And it seems like the payoff would be better mental clarity and focus, you know, once you're fully oxygenating and, you know, even really calming yourself down.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, just the simple act of breathing through the nose, I mean, that calms you. That's one of the better known methods from, you know, like Ayurvedic medicine for decreasing stress really fast and lowering the heart rate really fast is this concept or practice of alternate nostril breathing. It works so well. And if people are listening, they could try it. You just cover your left nostril and breathe in through your right nostril. And then you breathe out through your left nostril while keeping the right nostril still covered. And then you simply switch to the other side.
So breathe in with one of them and out with the other.
Yeah. You know, I've seen it a couple ways. Like sometimes people will also say breathe in through the right and then out through the left and then switch. Or you could breathe in through the right, then out through the right, then switch to the left and go in through the left, out through the left. I don't think it matters that much as long as you're alternating in some way the nostril through which you breathe. And you're just kind of using your finger to cover up the other one. And that's really good for decreasing the heart rate, or, you know, like you're stuck in a traffic jam and you're just like, you know, pissed and you want to get home and you're stressed out. Like obviously alternate nostril breathing during a workout doesn't work out that well, but it is a good stress control strategy.
And that's probably why meditation is so effective, is because you're following the breath and becoming, you know, way more aware of your breathing.
Yeah. Same thing with yoga, right?
Exactly.
All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed this conversation thus far. I'd like to take a quick break and thank this episode's sponsor, Yoga Body, makers of the Yoga Trapeze.
That's right. If you suffer from lower back pain, spinal traction can gently increase the space between your vertebrae 1 to 2 millimeters, and this can be enough to relieve many types of pain caused by compression. But of course, it can be challenging to hang upside down at home. So yoga teacher Lucas Rockwood came up with a unique solution called the Yoga Trapeze. It's a lightweight, versatile inversion sling that you can hang in a doorway or from an exposed beam.
Yeah, we actually have it in our basement because we have an exposed beam down there. and I will get in that thing, and sometimes I'll just relax in it, but yeah, definitely I'll hang upside down, and I'm slowly building up my time upside down, because when I first got in, I was like, whoa, I have not done this in years, not since I was a kid, you know?
Yeah. About 50% of the yoga trapeze users are yoga students who use it for posterior chain strength, core strength, and passive flexibility training. And then about the other 50% of users use it to hang for traction for their back issues.
So you can try the yoga trapeze for 30 days for $1. Just go to yogatrapeze.com, use the code MARATHON, and you'll get a free instructional DVD with your order so you'll know what you're doing. That's yogatrapeze.com and use the code MARATHON. So you seem like a guy who, if I walked through your house, you'd have every square foot optimized for health and productivity. Am I right?
Yeah, like tens of thousands of dollars of biohacks and medical technologies in my basement. Yeah, no, it is true.
So if people wanted to do that, if they wanted to upgrade their house but not spend tens of thousands of dollars, what are some more, you know, like cheaper but yet effective things they could do?
I think this concept of, especially all the data I see coming out on this, there's a really good researcher named Dr. Michael Hamblin, who probably has the lion's share of the data you could find on PubMed, but it's this concept of what's called photobiomodulation, like the use of near-infrared and far-infrared and red light to increase your mitochondrial health or to increase your nitric oxide production, either pre-workout or for recovery. You know, there's a lot of companies like Juve is one that I've worked with in the past that will create like these light panels that you would stand in front of to just like bathe your body in near infrared and red light. And I actually do that every morning. It's kind of like this big rush of blood for the whole body. And it also increases your mitochondrial health. And even especially guys who do it nude, it's been even shown to increase your testosterone. And so, you know, it's just basically using light. And you could do the same thing with sunlight. Like, don't get me wrong, I'm not a fan of spending a bunch of money on something, but then not also taking advantage of the natural solution. But, you know, if you are inside and you can't get out in the sun, or it's winter, or, you know, you're at work and you just got to be indoors, but you can at least use one of these lights, or it's nighttime and you want to use it for recovery after a hard day, I'm a big fan of either those, or, you know, it's a little bit more expensive, but also like these infrared saunas that you can get that are really good for recovery and muscle maintenance and nitric oxide production, and even a little bit of, you know, detoxification of, you know, via sweating through the skin, you know. And they can of course also be used to acclimate yourself to preparing for a hot race. They can be used to do things like increase red blood cell production, but, you know, either using some kind of infrared or red light therapy, or getting infrared sauna, or both. You know, I that was my quote workout unquote this morning, was I sipped my coffee and, you know, went through some of my emails and things while I had this, you know, red light bathing my body. But during that same time, I had my sauna heating up to get really hot. And then I went in the sauna and I did about 30 minutes of kind of Bikram style yoga in the sauna. So my heart rate got really high. I was sweating, and it was good because I lifted weights yesterday, right? So I'm not going to wake up and lift weights again this morning or do a hard session because my body's still kind of torn up from yesterday. But doing something like that passive is not only increasing my recovery, but I like it because my heart rate gets really high. So I'm also building my cardiovascular efficiency, but I'm building it without necessarily tearing up the rest of the body, right? Like, I'm not getting the heart rate high by running or by cycling or swimming or lifting weights. It's just getting high because my heart has to freaking pump a bunch of blood around my body to keep me cool. So
do you have one of those red light saunas then?
Yeah, I have one made by a company called Clear Light. It's called a sanctuary sauna. Like, it's designed to be a 4-person sauna, but, you know, one person can easily do exercises and yoga and things like that in there. You know, I've even at one point dragged my bike trainer in there, you know, done a bike session in the sauna. Like, it's pretty big. So, mm-hmm. So I'm a fan of that. That's one thing I've found to be useful.
Is it kind of like one of those that sits outside, looks like a giant wine barrel?
No, that's a dry sauna, like a barrel sauna.
Okay.
And those are pretty popular too. But I actually like the infrared because even though they don't get as hot inside, the infrared photons, those penetrate more deeply into tissue. So you heat up a lot more tissue and you sweat a lot more. And they're also big, so you can move around in them. So I'm a fan of that. So that's one thing. Another one is like a hypoxic training device that allows you to simulate altitude. And even if you're not training for a race at altitude, whenever you're breathing, very little oxygen for brief periods of time, followed by really, really large amounts of oxygen, like your blood vessels dilate and constrict and dilate and constrict. And so you get blood moving all over the body, but you also build a lot more mitochondria, which are really an aerobic athlete's best friend as far as producing ATP during exercise. And they make these devices called EWOT devices. It stands for exercise with oxygen therapy. The one that I have is made by a company called Live O2. And I actually have, you could put it next to a treadmill. Mine's next to a bike. And you'll do a bike session where you'll do like 30 seconds hard, 30 seconds easy, but then you alternate between hypoxia and hyperoxia. Like you might do your hard efforts at hypoxia, meaning you flip this little switch and you're breathing almost no oxygen and you feel like you're suffocating. And then you get to the end of the recovery and you flip it back to full oxygen and you recover on full oxygen. And man, for building red blood cell and mitochondrial density really quickly, it's almost kind of like a cup of coffee for the brain too, because you feel all this blood rushing to your head. That's a pretty cool device. I'm a fan of some kind of exercise with oxygen therapy.
And tell us the name of that device one more time.
That one's called the Live O2, L-I-V-E O2. In many cases on my website, I've got interviews with these people where I go for an hour and a half with them and we kind of delve deep into the science of how they work and stuff. But yeah, that's kind of the basic overview. And let me see if I could think of maybe one more for fun here. So we've got, the other one that's interesting, it's kind of funny because a lot of these things are just simulations of what you could do for free outside, but they're kind of biohacks because they let you do it faster. Like I don't have time to like drive to 6,000 feet elevation and go train, but if I can just like flip the switch and do that in my office, great. It's not as natural, but thanks to technology, I can do it. Same thing with the light. Like I could go outside and just I live on a north facing slope, so I don't get much sun out here in the forest. And so like I'd have to get in my car and drive and, go find the sun and do it in a place where I could strip down naked so I could get my whole body. And, these light panels are just kind of like getting you the equivalent of that in your house. And the same could be said for this concept of like earthing or grounding, and there's a whole documentary, I think it's called Grounded, about how beneficial it is to get outside barefoot and like sleep outside and touch trees and touch rocks. And, the earth emits this natural electromagnetic field that has been proven to do things like decrease inflammation and improve healing and, improve your sleep. And, thing is, like at least for me right now, outside is covered in ice and snow. Like everything's frosted over. I can't really go outside in my bare feet. Or if I did, I get cold burns on the bottom of my feet. Mm-hmm. And so there are these handheld devices or mats. They're called PEMF devices, pulsed electromagnetic field therapy. Like there's the really big ones used in the racehorsing industry made by a company called Pulse Centers. They're like smaller handheld units or kind of less powerful, but still pretty effective units like the Flex Pulse or the Earth Pulse. There's another one called the ICES, the ICES. There's one called the Body Balance. But anyways, so they kind of do the same thing as going outside barefoot. Like usually like a mat you would stand on during work or like a little device you'd place in your body. But what I like is you can also use them as spot treatment for injuries because they actually do a really good job at decreasing inflammation. So you could basically, let's say you got a sore knee, you can take it and just like, during work, like have it there on your knee for like 30, 45 minutes. And it does a really good job at a repair as well. So that's called PEMF. That's another one you can find a lot of research on PubMed, pulsed electromagnetic field therapy. So if you want to increase your vernacular from this podcast, you've learned three new terms. Number one, photobiomodulation. That's the use of light for therapy or for performance. And then the other one I said was EWOT, that's exercise with oxygen therapy. So hopefully there's some things you could Google and look more into if you wanted to. So EWOT, photobiomodulation, then that last one is PEMF, or pulsed electromagnetic field therapy. So those are some terms you can look up as different kind of cool ways to use really what were originally like medical technologies or NASA technologies to kind of make your own body healthier or improve your performance, from your own home, because a lot of these things are now, just sold to the general public.
And I suppose if you want to save money, you can drive to the mountains on a sunny day and run naked through the forest. yeah. Yes. Accomplish that.
Exactly.
And might be kind of hard to explain,
you.
Though, if yeah, you run into anyone.
Yeah, the cops come up. Like, I'm doing photobiomodulation EWOT PEMF. That's all.
They're like, okay, buddy.
Just go visit Ben Greenfield's website. I remember hearing a story about Benjamin Franklin that he would take a sunshine bath frequently, where he would just open his door and step out naked on his balcony downtown Philadelphia.
Yeah. It's a sight no one wants to see.
Well, I do that in the summer, you know, because I live on 10 acres. I've got no neighbors, right? So in the summer, I can do that. It's just like, you know, it's only half the year I can go out and do that. And even then, you know, UPS and FedEx and whoever shows, you just never know. My wife and my kids don't care. Heck, my little twin 10-year-old boys, they're, seems like every summer, half the time, they're just outside running around the forest naked. I'm not kidding.
Hard to keep clothes on.
All their clothes and out they go. And you know what? I think the pros outweigh the cons, so I don't correct them. But yeah, it is certainly something that you can do. And there's research going as far back as the 1940s that show that sun exposure to the genitals, particularly in guys, increases testosterone. So, you know, there's maybe a little bit of an anabolic effect there for guys too.
Just don't get sunburned.
Yeah.
You know, I think every like ultra runner that we've had on the podcast has a story about running naked at some point. I mean, I know that Dean Karnazes has like a chapter in his book about that. Bart Yasso, yeah. He did the Bear Buns fun run in Washington. He's got a chapter about that. So I bet it happens more than we think.
Yeah. Yeah. The Bear Buns fun run. I think that's only like an hour from my house, actually.
There you go.
So you mentioned your kids and we have young kids as well. I read on your website that you were a pretty studious young man that graduated at 15 or went to college at 15 and played the violin and wrote fantasy fiction. And so sounds mm-hmm. like, so how did your parents, how did they raise you?
Well, my dad was from Miami and my mom from Detroit. They were kind of like big city folk who moved to Idaho and kind of wanted to live a more, I guess, natural, quiet life out there and raise their kids in a less crime-filled, peer pressure type of situation they grew up in. So yeah, we were homeschooled in North Idaho, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, my parents kind of used a hybrid model. They would hire some tutors for me for things like algebra or creative writing, or, let's see, we had an art tutor that would come over to the house. I had a violin teacher, you know, and we were part of a big kind of group of homeschoolers in the area. So we'd have like chess club at our house and we'd have like whatever, you know, like kind of some group learnings where we'd all go on field trips together. So, you know, it wasn't like we were just like hanging out by ourselves, socially isolated and, you know, right. Not to use this term too much, but, you know, barefoot and just being little dirty hippies. Like it was somewhat structured. And, you know, because I wasn't learning at the pace of an entire classroom, but at my own pace, you know, I was able to get through my coursework pretty quickly and effectively. And I was blessed in that I was an independent learner, always have been, you know, just intensely curious about anything I'm studying and really driven to learn. And so for me, it worked out pretty well. Just kind of, you know, it was kind of a combination of these tutors and my parents getting curriculum and me kind of, you know, taking charge and just like, you know, my mom would say, hey, you got to get through whatever this Saxon math book and here's your deadline and you just go through it. And so, you know, it worked out pretty well for me and kind of left me with a great deal of kind of like independence and kind of like self-reliance when it comes to education. But, you know, I think that takes the right personality of a child. I think it also takes the right kind of parents who have a heart to teach, who really want to, you know, spend a lot of time with their kids, you know, at the kitchen table, or parents with a pretty high disposable income, right, who would maybe, you know, I was like kind of a middle class family. So it's not like my parents were spending tons of money on fancy tutors. It's just like, you know, you get four families together and you hire one tutor and split them between the four families. And, you know, everybody comes over to the house on a Wednesday afternoon and a Friday afternoon for the art class for that week. You know, mm-hmm. that was kind of the way that they would do things. So kind of a co-op type of scenario.
Yeah.
You know, but for us and our kids, we homeschooled them for the first couple of years. And my wife, she's a wonderful, wonderful woman, and she's great at teaching arts and crafts. And, you know, we live relatively off-grid out here. We grow our own food, and so, you know, we've got goats and chickens and vegetable garden and fruit trees, and, you know, she does a lot of that. She's kind of a ranch girl, but, you know, she didn't like school. She was, for the most part, dyslexic. You know, she doesn't have the heart of a teacher, and, you know, with me, as much as I'm gallivanting about the globe, racing and speaking and, you know, doing what I do, it's kind of unfair to the kids to have one person at home who hates to teach and then one person there teaching half the time but gone half the time. So we wound up just shifting them into more of a private school. And then we kind of have this philosophy, I guess you would almost call it unschooling, right? Where, mm-hmm. you know, you do all the things that your children aren't learning in school. You make sure they learn that stuff when they're at home. Like, you know, in our case, it's wilderness survival or shooting the bow or, you know, my kids have a food podcast, like a food and cooking podcast that they do as their business. And, you know, we do a lot of, we do a lot of extracurricular activities. I'll take them through at home. Like I mentioned, I'm doing jiu-jitsu right now, but really I'm just doing it because I know the value of learning a martial arts and the honor and respectability and self-discipline that requires at an early age. So I figure I'm not going to put my kids in jiu-jitsu and not be a good example and show them also that, you know, dad sees the importance in this too. So I go to jiu-jitsu with them. And so I try to create a scenario where I don't really like send them off to school and assume they're getting everything they need in life at school, right? They're learning some of the core curriculum and they're learning how to play well with others and cooperate in group situations and, you know, and take a lot of the extracurriculars that I can't teach or don't have the knowledge to teach. But then when they come home, it's like, okay, well, your education is done. And now we can just like, you guys get your homework done and we'll watch TV and, you know, and eat dinner. Like, I really go out of my way to make sure I enrich their education as much yeah. as I can at home. And I think that kind of gives you the best of both worlds. It's kind of like a combination of homeschooling and regular schooling, or what you might call nowadays, I guess the word is unschooling and regular schooling.
That's awesome. So I know a big struggle for parents who want to raise their kids to be high achievers and also to be healthy is the topic of screen time. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that, like what you guys do, or also, you know, studies yeah. and what you thought about the studies into the effects of screens yeah. on our brains.
Well, I think everyone's aware of the studies, you know, the bright light at night disrupting sleep, or the effect of Wi-Fi or cell signals on, you know, like a child's rapidly dividing neurons in their skull, or, you know, their thinner skulls overall, and the fact that those phones can penetrate more deeply into their neural tissue, or, you know, like for young boys, it's going to sound like I'm obsessed with testicles. I keep bringing them up, but, you know, like, you know, that really affects your sperm, and even like future generations to be, you know, cause kids, you hand them a phone and automatically it kind of goes down in the lap, right? And they're kind of hunched over with that phone just right next to their little gonads. You know, it's not a good thing. And the data is pretty profound. Probably the best book on this right now in layman's term that lays this all out is called The Non-Tinfoil Hat Guide to EMF, written by a guy named Nicholas Pinnell. You can get it on Amazon. You read that book, you're just like, holy cow, there are so many effects of 5G and Wi-Fi and even Bluetooth to a certain extent. You know, and I don't want my kid to grow up just fried, you know,
yeah.
half their life, or, you know, get to the age of 18 and have what's called electrical sensitivity, where they get near a Wi-Fi router and they just kind of go into auto brain fog, which happens to people. Hmm. So anyways, in our house, we kind of have the same stance on phone and screen time and internet use as we do on everything else. Meaning we parent with this philosophy that you don't tell your children no, you don't create these hard and fast rules in the house. You don't do things like basically create forbidden fruit by taking things away from a child or banning them from it. So, for example, alcohol, right? Like my first experience with alcohol, because my family was pretty strict with alcohol. And, you know, if the parents are drinking wine at the table, no, kids, that's not, don't touch that. You know, kids can't go near alcohol, or even sometimes like alcohol is bad for you, which never made sense to me because like the adults are drinking it. So, you know, one of my dad's friends gave him like a bottle of scotch, like a fancy bottle of scotch one year. And my first experience with alcohol was I was like, I really want to see what this stuff is like. The adults seem to really dig this and I've seen it in movies. And so I just like took the bottle and drank it in my bedroom and got, you know, horribly sick and nauseous. And it's like, that's not a good first experience with alcohol. You know, whereas with our kids, we'll pour wine and, you know, get a good little bottle and pour some into a shot glass and teach my children how to recognize the scent and the notes and the floral and the flavor and learn to kind of appreciate that and where it came from. And here's the vineyard that it was at. And, you know, so my kids are never going to like take a bottle of wine from the pantry and drink the whole thing. That'd be silly. You know, that, but they have a very healthy appreciation for alcohol and its benefits. And also the fact that, that, you know, they do need to be careful. You know, I've taught them, you know, young liver can only process, you know, so much, and you should be very careful with anything like this, especially until you're, you know, 18 to 21 years old. But I never say like, you know, alcohol is bad, don't drink alcohol. Or, you know, the same could be said for gluten, right? I'm never like, oh, don't eat gluten. Can't have the cupcakes at your friend's birthday party, or when the bread comes to the table at this restaurant, like, don't eat it because it's got gluten. Instead, I'm just like, hey, you know, gluten can cause some damage to your gut, son. It can induce a little bit of brain fog and some neural damage that could affect your performance at school the next day. You know, dad will occasionally have a piece of bread at the restaurant, but usually I'll kind of stop there because part of it is, you know, part of the dose is in the poison, like how much of it that you consume, and then, you know, just let them make the choice. And, you know, they'll go to a friend's birthday party and yeah, they'll bring out the cupcakes and my kids will have like half a cupcake or a smaller piece of cake. And they'll be like, hey dad, I had some of the cupcake and, you know, it wasn't gluten free, but I just had a little bit and it's pretty good. But, you know, and you know, we even have supplements at home like that digest gluten for you or kind of protect the lining of the gut. And they'll come home from the birthday party and like take a shot of like Restore, which is really good for glyphosate exposure, or, you know, gluten digesting enzyme, which helps them digest gluten. And so they're kind of aware of like mitigating some of the damage. But again, there's no rule. And with screen time, it's like, you know, I've told them everything I know about Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, and their first basketball game is tomorrow night. So last night we were watching Hoosiers, right? And so I put on my they're called blue light blocking glasses. They help you look at screens at night and still be able to sleep. You know, I don't tell my kids to put on theirs, but I do say, hey, I'm going to go grab my blue light blocking glasses. Do you want me to grab your guys' from your room, or you know, I can go get mine? You know, they'll just kind of see dad demonstrating and then they'll go ahead and get them. Whereas if I were to say, go put on your blue light blocking glasses or you can't watch that movie, the last thing they're going to want to do is put on glasses, because all of a sudden, you know, that's like the rule. And, you know, children at heart are, you know, they're kind of rule breakers to a certain extent, or it creates that forbidden fruit scenario. And the same thing with a phone, right? I will hand them the phone and be like, you know, I'll say, okay, so here's how to place it in airplane mode. Here's how to disable the Wi-Fi and the Bluetooth if you need to disable that. Here's how you adjust the screen brightness if it's night and you want to decrease the screen brightness so you sleep better. Here you go. And they can have that phone as long as they please. But I simply educate them about the consequences of their decisions, then let them take the responsibility for the actions. And I think that creates a more kind of free-thinking, independent young adult who's able to make decisions for themselves, rather than one who lives in a house full of rules and never really learns like why the rules exist or the consequences of, you know, making certain decisions. And so with screen time, it's pretty much free reign, as much as you want. And my kids might watch like one movie every 2 weeks or so, and they'll play on the phone for maybe 15, 20 minutes a day. And the rest of the time, they're just like outside. They love to be outdoors. We make sure they've got lots of fun things to do outdoors, like, you know, sleds and tree forts and, you know, goats and chickens and all sorts of things outside. And plus it helps too that, you know, aside from my work, you know, dad and mom, like, we don't have our phones at the kitchen table, and we limit our own screen time. So it's a combination of educating your children about taking responsibility for their actions, and then also demonstrating proper actions. And you could even say that for workouts, right? Like, I will go work out in the garage, and a lot of times I'll wait till my kids get home from school, because research has shown that your child is prone to be more fit and appreciate fitness more if they observe their parent exercising or get the impression that their parent is prioritizing setting aside a time to exercise. Some really interesting research from University of Essex on this. And so I'll wait sometimes until they get home to exercise, and then I'll go do my workout, but I'll just be like, hey, I'm going to the garage. Here's the workout I'm doing. I'll grab a couple of lighter sandbags and lighter kettlebells if you guys want to join. And sometimes I'll get like 10 minutes into my workout, and one of them will fling open the door and come out and look at the little workout I've got written down on a post-it note and do a couple of rounds and then go back inside, you know, to read Harry Potter or whatever. And so it's just all about being a good example and also really educating your child about how to do something or the consequences of doing something.
Well, Ben, we appreciate your time and all the tips that you shared. So if people want to keep up with what you're doing, check you out online, find your podcasts, so forth, where can we send them?
Yeah, it's just BenGreenfieldFitness.com. Pretty easy. I got my blog, my podcast, everything I recommend or use over there. So that's kind of the best spot is just BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
All right. Perfect.
Cool. Well, thank you guys. I appreciate the opportunity to come on. I wish everyone best of luck. And if folks are listening, they have follow-up questions, if you do, just ping me on my website and I'm happy to point you in the right direction.
Awesome. Thanks so much for your time.
Appreciate that.
Thank you guys.
All right. Have a good one.
Thank you.
All right. Later.
All right. Well, in just a moment, we want to talk about how to stay marathon ready. And we've got a great question about that from a listener. But before we get into that, we'd like to say a quick word of thanks to our episode sponsor, MetPro, a proven platform to help runners reduce body weight, increase power, and optimize their metabolic rate to maintain energy and performance. We had the founder of MetPro, Angelo Poli, on the podcast. He talked about how to figure out your body's metabolic rate and how it's unfair because everyone's metabolism is different.
Yeah, that's right.
And the principle of contrast when it comes to losing weight. And let me tell you, these people know what they're doing. And we've really enjoyed working with our nutritionist, Natalie. And Angie, things are going even better for you because you actually do all the workouts faithfully. So maybe I'll let you talk about it.
Yes, this has been really an answer to prayer for me because I was stuck with my weight for a number of years despite my activity level and just really needed the key strategy of understanding my metabolism and that contrast to be able to see some results. And I've been able to lose 21 pounds since we started at the end of November, which I am just thrilled with. I feel stronger than ever. And I'm so thankful, of course, to MetPro for the system they set up and for the coaching that we've been able to get to make this possible.
So MetPro is a concierge service that it's very high touch and the cost is not going to be, in everyone's budget, but we've been really happy with the results. So to learn more, just go to metpro.co/MTA, and that's a .co, not a .com. That's metpro.co, MetPro standing for metabolic profiling. That's metpro.co/MTA to get started.
We'd also like to thank Athletic Greens. Athletic Greens is the best of the best in all-in-one whole food supplements and the easiest way to build a healthy habit each and every morning. It was developed over 10 years by doctors, nutritionists, and naturopaths, and it's the most complete whole food supplement available with 75 whole food sourced ingredients. Not to mention that one scoop has the antioxidant equivalent of 12 servings of fruit and vegetables. So it helps to fuel energy, boost immunity, support digestion and gut health, and support healthy aging. I've been using it every morning, and I really feel like it gives me a great start to my day.
That's right. And they have a special deal for our listeners. You can get 20 travel packs for free, valued at $79. Along with your first purchase, just go to athleticgreens.com/MTA to claim your special offer, athleticgreens.com/MTA. Well, now it's time for this episode's quick tip. And we're going to talk about how to stay marathon ready so you can do that last minute race that you heard about or that your friend is begging you to jump in on. And this actually is from a question that we got from a listener named Diane. She says, hello, longtime podcast listener here. Wondering if you would consider addressing this question on an upcoming podcast. Angie, how do you stay marathon ready? I've been following 2 marathon training plans per year, but recently had the opportunity to jump in on a third marathon at the last minute. I let the opportunity pass me since my longest training run completed at that point was only 16 miles. So to make a long story short, I would love to do more than 2 marathons per year. What tips do you have for doing more frequent marathons? I'm assuming you do follow a non-traditional training plan. Thanks in advance. And that comes from Diane.
Yeah, that's a great question, Diane. And we really appreciate you being a longtime listener, of course. It is very possible to train for multiple marathons per year and have a great experience and a great time doing it. What a runner does for training is going to depend on how close the marathons are that you want to do and your general health and fitness. Obviously, I wouldn't recommend that a person run multiple marathons a year unless they're injury-free and they're committed to doing the necessary recovering and cross-training work to stay strong. I also don't recommend that a very new runner do multiple marathons per year just because your chance of injury increases. But the first thing you want to do if you want to do multiple marathons or longer races per year is to make sure that you have a good endurance base. This can usually be accomplished as you train for your first marathon of the year, because I do recommend that people take a few weeks as an off season at some point. I feel like it is important to give your body some step back weeks at some point in the year, you know, it's just to recover physically, maybe mentally, from the demands of training. So if you build that good endurance base, this is going to ensure that when you increase your mileage for your upcoming marathons, you'll have less chance of injury. And as you train for your upcoming marathons, you really want to train for the courses that you'll be running by adding things like hill training, trails, if you'll be running a trail marathon. Just, you know, think about the elevation that you'll be running so that you can be as prepared as possible. You'll also want to continue with regular low-impact cross training and strength work, because that's going to balance and strengthen your body and help you become a stronger overall runner. The third thing you'll want to do is to identify any A races that you have. What I mean by that is that it's unlikely that you'll be able to PR at all of your events if you do multiple marathons, so having a specific goal for each one can be helpful. Some races can be used as training runs, some can be done with friends, some can be paced to support your future training goals. So there can be a lot of different reasons to do marathons, not just getting PRs at every one.
Yeah, we're getting a lot of clients right now signing up for MTA coaching whose their A races are Chicago, which is in October, early October. But most of them have like at least one more marathon or half marathons before Chicago comes around.
Exactly. So kind of building that race calendar out for the year can be really helpful to help you identify your goals, and that's going to really give some guidance to your training. So write out the dates of your races so that you can plan tapering time before each marathon and also recovery time afterward. When you do close races, it's really important to prioritize rest and recovery. You'll hear us talk about that a lot on this show, because it's just something that if you push yourself hard 24/7, you know, something's going to break eventually. My advice would be to peak your training 3 weeks before your marathon and then take a couple of recovery weeks after the marathon. Then if you're feeling good, you can jump back into your training plan the correct number of weeks out from your next scheduled race.
What do you mean by peak your training?
So let's say your longest run is a 20-miler. You're going to want to do that 3 weeks before your first marathon. So it's going to be probably your highest mileage of your training plan. That'll be your peak week. And then after that, you're going to go into your taper to, you know, help your body bounce back so that you can, you know, get to that starting line feeling strong and healthy and have a great marathon. Of course, you want to make sure that you're not dealing with any injuries, niggles, issues, and that you're healthy before you jump back into training again for your next race, because it's really important that you stay healthy through this process. Of course, if you've run a 16-mile long run in the past 3 to 4 weeks and you're an experienced runner, I really don't think it's necessary to jump back up to a 20-miler before doing a last-minute marathon. You know, many people think they have to like have that 20-miler in a certain number of weeks out before their marathon. But, you know, if you're doing multiple marathons, you're not going to have time for like those full progression of long runs. So I would say, you know, if you're experienced enough, I would say a 16-miler is enough of a long run before tapering down a couple of weeks for another marathon. Of course, factors like listening to your body and taking care of any issues when they're minor, and training smart by including plenty of easy days in your schedule, keeping that cross training going, dialing in your nutrition by cutting back on processed foods and sugar, which are going to increase inflammation in your body, and getting plenty of sleep is all going to make multiple races possible and more pleasant. So you can't really burn the candle on both ends. You know, if you're not taking that time for recovery and you want to do a lot of races, you know, something's going to give. So you really have to be committed to the process of training smart and training healthy. Since there aren't any traditional training plans that are geared toward doing multiple marathons a year, it can be a matter of experimenting a bit on yourself and modifying existing training plans that have worked well for you in the past. Another option that some people do is having a customized training plan made by a coach for your specific needs. So, you know, they can schedule in each of those races and build the training plan around that. And like Trevor said, many runners who do more than 2 marathons or multiple races a year find that hiring a running coach works really well to keep them performing at their best and staying healthy, because it really takes the guesswork out of the process, which can be really stressful for a lot of people.
Now, you've done anywhere between what, like 3 to 9 marathons a year for a good while now, maybe 9 years in a row. Have you found that it's getting harder, like the older that you get?
I find I have to be more intentional about my recovery. And also I can't run each of the marathons as hard. Like when I was in my earlier 30s, you know, I could, like every 6 weeks, I could pump out a good effort at a marathon and get a fairly consistent finishing time. Now, if I try to do races too close together, they're probably going to slow down a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I may be hurting after doing them too close together. So everyone's going to kind of find their sweet spot. It's going to depend, of course, on your age, how fast you recover, and a lot of those things that you're doing for recovery. I mean, for me, getting 8 hours of sleep a night is absolutely key to keeping myself strong and healthy. And so I know that about myself. I have to prioritize sleep. Keeping sugar at low levels in my diet is also key for me to feel good and to not start having joint issues and a bunch of inflammation. So you kind of will figure out like what your body needs specifically to be able to perform at a higher level while doing multiple races.
All right. Well, I hope that helps. Thanks for the question, Diane. And I know there's lots of folks that listen to the podcast that like to do multiple races a year. Marathon Maniacs Club, you know, Half Fanatics Club. Lots of you folks that are listening. So be careful with the recovery and listen to your body, of course. That is always good advice, right?
That's right.
That brings us to the end of this episode. Thanks again to Athletic Greens, the best all-in-one whole food supplement. Just go to athleticgreens.com/MTA to claim your special offer. And thanks also to MetPro, a world-renowned concierge nutrition, fitness, and lifestyle coaching company. Their team of experts specialize in developing customized training and nutrition programs using metabolic profiling. They analyze your metabolism and will provide you with an individualized strategy to obtain your goals. Just visit metpro.co/MTA to get started. And don't forget, you can read the show notes to our episode today and find all the links over on our website, marathontrainingacademy.com. We also have lots of articles and resources over there, as well as other podcast episodes and our itinerary if you want to see where we're going to be at. We always love meeting and connecting with runners. And you can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Marathon Academy. You guys are awesome. Keep running out there. And remember, you have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life. Well on my way, well on my way. Oh, wait.